From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the results of the latest Flint water test. Is the lead going down? Plus, we look at the social costs of that water disaster.
U.S. society and U.S. policymakers are particularly resistant to investing in things that can prevent tragic events like this.
Improving things for startups in Michigan.
When you're a state trying to invent a startup ecosystem from nothing, it's pretty amazing what we've been able to achieve.
Dark money paying to smear certain candidates in last week's state primary.
This was an effort, a pretty well orchestrated effort, to keep extremely conservative candidates out of the House GOP caucus.
And giving primary care physicians a helping hand toward patient-centered care in Michigan. Those stories and much more today on Stateside. But now, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for joining us. Secret donors and dark money playing out in the state primary. Meteor shower aficionados gearing up. And the transformation of primary care in Michigan. All of that and more in the hour to come. But first, just 3 days before the federal disaster declaration expires in Flint, Virginia Tech water expert Mark Edwards has released the results of the latest water tests he did in Flint. Michigan Radio's Steve Carmody is here with us. Steve, was it thumbs up or thumbs down today from Professor Edwards, or something in between?
It was more something in between. Mark Edwards talked about the results and how they show that lead levels are coming down, and now the city is somewhat below the federal action level. But again, much like Flint water itself, the answer is rather murky.
Rather murky. Are they finding that there are fewer people reporting that detectable level of lead that they were finding, I mean, off the charts when they started testing a year ago?
Yes. A year ago when they did testing, and they tested nearly 300 homes, or the water in 300 homes, only about 9% of the homes where they tested had lead levels that were non-detectable. In this latest round of testing that they did earlier this summer, 45% of the homes that they tested had non-detectable levels of lead. That's a significant improvement. But for the other 55% that did have some levels of lead, it still was a significant amount of lead. And at this point, Mark Edwards is still saying, while things are improving and have dramatically improved since last year, he says people should continue to use filtered or bottled water.
What does he attribute the improvement to?
Well, Mark Edwards credits the work that's been done on the city, state, and federal levels to improve corrosion controls and other measures.
So when he's talking about healing, Steve, he's really talking about fixing these ravaged pipelines.
Yes, the corrosion controls, basically what they've been doing with these added chemicals is trying to recreate a biofilm within the pipes, which separates the water passing through the pipes from the metal pipes themselves. A lot of that was ripped away from the highly corrosive Flint River water that wasn't properly treated at the time. So what they've been doing with the corrosion controls is trying to reestablish that biofilm within and, in effect, heal the pipes from within.
Now, where does all of this leave people as far as when they might be able to trust the water from their taps?
At this point, Mark Edwards is expecting that over the next 6 to 12 months, the city should see significant, dramatic improvement in its water quality. He said this could be the beginning of the end of the city's public health crisis. Now, not everyone is 100% on board with this. For example, activist Melissa Mays, she has her doubts about the results in this round of testing.
I think that is a completely confusing message. If they're telling people to still use filters, that means there's still a problem.
I can hear it in her voice.
Yeah, absolutely. She was not happy with what she heard from Mark Edwards. And she says herself she recently had water tested, not in her home, but in the pipe leading into her home. And it had higher levels of lead than it had back when the city was back on the Flint River. So she says in her home, the problem is not getting any better.
So as you say, Steve, you put it pretty well, it is a murky situation continuing.
Absolutely.
Michigan Radio, Steve Carmody, checking in with the latest in water reports from Flint. Thanks so much, Steve.
You're welcome.
Mm-hmm. The EAA, Education Achievement Authority, was Governor Snyder's big experiment to try to turn around Detroit's most struggling schools. It took 15 schools away from the Detroit public school system and let the state created EAA do the teaching. Critics slammed the EAA as being expensive, ineffective. There's been high turnover both in students and teachers, questionable spending on expenses and travel. The EAA will come to an end when its schools rejoin Detroit's district a year from now. Right now, though, there is a battle between the Detroit Public Schools and the EAA over $12 million in outstanding rent payments the EAA may or may not owe DPS. Let's turn now to Michigan Radio's Sarah Swick to help us figure this all out. The $12 million they're fighting over, Sarah, is for what exactly?
The $12 million that we're talking about is being characterized as rent payments, and that's not entirely inaccurate, but essentially when the EAA started up in 2012, it started up with and still only has the 15 schools that all were former Detroit public schools, and the EAA is actually leasing them from the former DPS for just $1 a year. What these payments actually covered were the portion of the historic debt payments that each of those EAA, now EAA students, would have covered for DPS. So essentially they were paying off DPS's historic debts so that DPS didn't have to carry on that burden on its own.
And EAA is claiming that the state bailout package for Detroit schools wiped away the lease debt. What did you find from reading that legislation? Anything that backs up the EAA claim?
So there is nothing that I could find in the legislation itself that indicated that the money, that there would be any sort of wiping clean of these debts or that any money should be transferred to the EAA. In fact, if I can read some of the language, it says that the money that the state did appropriate to the new Detroit Public Schools to start up this new district can only be used to offset directly or indirectly the absence of local school operating revenues. So that means the property taxes that would have normally gone to cover school expenses now that stays with the old school district is what's paying off this historic debt now. So basically that sort of puts it all in the hands of the head of the Detroit Public Schools to decide, you know, how to appropriate this money. And right now the head of that is a transition manager, former emergency manager Stephen Rhodes, who is an appointee of Governor Snyder.
And the EAA is saying, hey, the governor assured us the rent owed, taken care of, wiped away. What is Governor Snyder's office saying or doing about the dispute?
So the EAA has been very, very vehement and provided to Michigan Radio a number of documents and a pretty detailed timeline saying they had the understanding or had been assured by the Department of Treasury and members of Governor Snyder's administration that, hey, these past debts that you owe to the Detroit Public Schools for these rent payments would be wiped out. And in fact, their board went ahead and approved a budget just at the end of June based on that assumption. But it turns out that this amended lease agreement that was supposed to sort of wipe that out, because again, it's the transition manager for the new Detroit Public Schools that has to do that, was never formally approved. And the EAA and DPS are still talking. And then the state is saying now they should keep talking. But the EAA is saying, hey, we really were under the impression that these debts had been wiped clean.
So the governor's office is kind of saying, you guys figure it out?
Yeah, at this point, even though both of these entities that we're talking about, the new Detroit Public Schools and the Education Achievement Authority, are at this point sort of directly or are directly under state control, they're saying it's between these two entities to sort of work out amongst themselves.
Now, but DPS, in the meantime, I'm sure that $12 million means a lot in such a cash-strapped situation.
It does mean a lot. I mean, the reason that, there's sort of disagreements about whether rent payments were ever delinquent or ever, but they were behind on these payments and had worked out a payment plan with DPS. And then apparently this confusion started at the end of last year but the EA is actively seeking to sort of cancel these payments. So, yeah, they're not in a great financial position, but obviously neither is Detroit Public Schools. So it's a tough situation.
So here's this $12 million difference of opinion. What is due to happen next, or do we know?
That's a really good question. I think they're still talking. I can read you a statement from a spokesperson for the Detroit Public Schools. She says that the DPS is still negotiating with the EAA, but Judge Rhodes, that's the transition manager, is not obligated to waive debt as the fiduciary overseer of the district. So It appears at this point that DPS is still saying, hey, we could really use that money. But the EAA was saying, wait a minute, we got assurances from the state that we don't owe you that money. So it really appears that the right people were not communicating with each other here.
We will watch this unfold. Michigan Radio, Sarah Swick, as always. Thanks so much, Sarah.
Thank you, as always.
And now we dip into the mailbag to read some of your emails. Last Wednesday, you recall, we spoke with author Joe Grimm about the history, the vendors, and the various versions of Michigan's culinary treasure, the Coney Dog. That interview caused some of your mouths to collectively water. And that includes Kate's, a listener in New Mexico, who emailed us to say, my hometown of Muskegon calls Coney's Greek chili dogs. And whenever I return home from my current residence in Albuquerque, I head straight to G&L for my fix. On the following day, August 4th, we spoke with two University of Michigan pediatricians about their recent editorial in Slate, in which they called for an end to vaccination exemptions. As any conversation about vaccines does, this one generated plenty of discussion, and a few of you emailed to express your displeasure, including Ryan, who wrote in part, I was disappointed to hear a Michigan radio program give voice to two speakers who advocated the elimination of individual free choice. I would be very happy to hear a much more balanced program, though I must admit I am hesitant to hold my breath. If you have a comment or question, we would love to hear it. Just send us an email, stateside@michiganradio.org. Coming up in 10 minutes, improving the situation for startups in Michigan. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It is pretty tough to wrap your mind around the price tag for Flint's lead and water disaster. There's the $58 million the state of Michigan has already spent on filters, bottled water, and medical care and testing. There's the still undetermined cost of replacing the water lines and the pipes damaged by the corrosive Flint River water. But we cannot overlook the social costs. That warning comes from Peter Munig. He's professor of health policy and management at Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health. And his warning is in a letter he wrote in the journal Health Affairs. Peter Munig is with us now. Welcome, Peter.
Hello.
First of all, what exactly are social costs?
Social costs sort of reflect what everybody in society has to pay for something. So regardless of who pays, you might think about a government cost as something that would happen to a specific government institution or a corporate cost as separate, but societal cost is just every cost that anybody can incur.
What kind? Could you break down what those elements might look like?
We're looking at lost productivity costs. We're looking at incarceration costs. That's a big one. And then we're looking at costs associated with use of welfare services, things like that.
What do you then calculate as the social cost of the Flint lead crisis?
For each kid exposed over their lifetime, we figure it comes out to about $50,000.
All right. Can you help me understand the headline that I saw that said $395 million?
What that is it's the average kid over their entire lifetime. That includes higher welfare use, criminal justice systems costs, economic productivity losses that are associated with the neurological damage that occurs in children that are exposed to lead. You can imagine these kids are going to have a harder time in school and therefore have a harder time graduating from high school. And when you don't graduate from high school, it sort of sets off a cascade of things. It's harder to find a high-paying job. You end up needing to use more federal welfare program services like food stamps. All of these things sort of add up over time.
It was kind of a jolt as I was reading about your study. I think a lot of people who are not in public health are not aware of this epidemiological measure known as quality adjusted life years, a year's worth of exposures resulting in years of perfect health loss. That really hits at home in kind of a real human way.
Yeah, the QALY is a really powerful measure of health because it not only measures life lost, but it also measures the damages that happen to people's health.
And your calculations of the Flint exposures, so comes up to about 395 million and 1,760 of these QALYs, quality adjustment life years, equivalent to 27 children's lives.
Yes.
What does that say to legislators and policymakers?
Well, I think the main message is that it's a lot cheaper to prevent something terrible from happening than to wait until something terrible happens. And we see this over and over again in the U.S. For some reason, I sort of feel like U.S. society and U.S. policymakers are particularly resistant to investing in things that can prevent tragic events like this. So, you know, we saw this with Katrina. We see this over and over again. And people have been doing these analyses endlessly showing, you know, different ways that we could reduce exposure to children from all sorts of toxins, including lead. You know, some of them are quite expensive, but making the investment will produce returns because it will prevent terrible things from happening.
So what are some of these steps that we should get out in front of instead of waiting for some calamity to happen, a calamity like Flint?
As far as lead exposure goes, there are lots of different sources of lead exposure. But in this particular case, it was water-based. The EPA had done studies showing that you can do highly targeted lead abatement interventions where you identify those houses that are very likely to have that are very likely to be at high risk of corrosive incidents that have lead in the pipes. And, you know, replacing the pipes, it's not cheap, but it's a lot cheaper than having a kid with neurological damage.
And what can happen throughout that child's lifetime.
Exactly.
We've seen the U.S. lead health standard getting smaller and smaller over the past 50 years, no?
Mm-hmm.
But you feel what, we could and should still go lower?
Well, you know, there is no safe level of exposure to lead, but the damages associated with very, very, very small exposures is pretty small. Meaning what the average wealthier child living in a newer housing in the United States, but you know they're going to have like 1 or 2 micrograms per deciliter of lead in their blood, and that's the measure of how much lead is in their blood at any time. Levels that get much higher than that, they do produce damage. So when you just go 2 or 3 times as high as that, it produces a measurable effect on the IQ and also predisposes the kid to violent behavior throughout their life. It doesn't take much to get to the point at which bad things really start to happen.
When we think of your field of health policy and management, it seems that this is something that really is not just here in Michigan. I mean, is Flint truly the tip of the proverbial iceberg for this country?
Oh, yes, definitely. In terms of U.S. infrastructure problems, we have an infrastructure that has been aging for a long time, and a lot of that infrastructure has lead in it. A lot of the infrastructure is infrastructure that's supposed to hold things up and is slowly collapsing. We saw a large highway collapse a few years ago. Every day something happens at some small, almost not newsworthy level that potentially kills somebody. I think that there's bound to be other major big events that happen in the near future just because we haven't made these kinds of investments.
What lessons should the rest of the nation take away from what happened in Flint?
Do the studies, figure out how to most cost-effectively address them, and then fund it.
Peter Munich is professor of health policy and management at Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health. Peter, thanks for speaking with us.
Sure thing. Great to talk to you.
You're listening to Stateside, and if you miss any part of today's show, you can find it on our podcast. Just go to michiganradio.org and click on podcast to find the link, and we're on Twitter at Stateside Radio.
Opportunities.
Part of the community. The next idea.
A culture for innovation is a culture with a sense of destiny, a sense of that tomorrow is going to be better than today. That's what the word progress means.
July auto sales were lackluster, up an anemic 0.7%. Some analysts are wondering if the car makers will fall back to the incentives and special deals to pump new life into sales. And they're figuring 2016 will pretty much plateau at last year's sales. It's certainly not a doom and gloom situation, but it does awaken reminders of what happened to Michigan's economy when the Detroit Three were fighting for their lives during the Great Recession. That's when many in our state realized diversifying Michigan's economy is the key to survival. Well, let's look at how we've done towards that goal and how Michigan looks to potential investors and business owners. Sarah Schmidt is with us now. She's a reporter with Exconomy Detroit, Ann Arbor. Good to have you here, Sarah.
Thank you. Good to be here.
We certainly heard so much talk during and since the Great Recession that Michigan can't hitch its wagon solely to auto. We need to diversify. What has diversifying our economy looked like on the ground, let's say over the past 10 years?
Well, I don't know if you remember, Cynthia, but we, in 2005, Granholm's administration allocated money, $1 billion, from the National Tobacco Settlement to fund the 21st Century Jobs Fund. And the point of that was to, you know, initiate some formal efforts toward building an entrepreneurial ecosystem, toward getting our VC funds, we call them fund-to-funds, some of these programs.
VC meaning venture capital.
Meaning venture capital. Bust out the tech jargon. Yes, these programs have been implemented over the past 10 years. The results have been mostly positive. But, you know, when you're a state trying to invent a startup ecosystem from nothing, basically, it's pretty amazing what we've been able to achieve over this past 10 years.
There was a recent study commissioned by the Michigan Economic Development Corporation, the MEDC, that looked at exactly this, how we've done in diversifying our economy. And the report found some good news and pockets of bad news. And I'm wondering what jumped out at you most from that study, first in the area of good news.
There weren't a lot of surprises because we had already heard a lot of this good news in the Michigan Venture Capital Association report. And they, in fact, shared a lot of data with Techonomy. What we found is Michigan essentially had no kind of startup presence or scene at all. That is not the case anymore. So we were pretty successful in establishing a startup ecosystem from scratch. These fund-to-funds, they are funds that grant money, award money to individual VC firms. There's usually a stipulation that they have to invest in Michigan companies, but it's been a very effective way to not only encourage Michigan investors to participate in funding startups, but it's also drawn a lot of out-of-state money when, frankly, Michigan was not on anybody's radar 10 years ago.
So as a way, these fund-to-funds are saying, hey, look at us. We'll give you some money to get the ball rolling and to come take a look at Michigan.
Correct. And they have been very effective in oftentimes, a Michigan startup, their first outside investment will come from one of these fund-to-funds or one of these funds funded by a fund-to-fund.
Yep.
So they have been integral in de-risking some of this very early stage technology that's under development here. The fund-to-funds have been extremely successful, and I agree completely with the report's recommendation that we find a way to continue them, sure, maybe restructured, mm-hmm. maybe we make them public-private, not all public, but they do need to continue because they've been very effective.
And the pockets of bad news.
In our ecosystem here in Michigan, it's very siloed. There are a lot of efforts that are duplicated unnecessarily. I don't know why we haven't been able to get a handle on that, but I know that efforts are underway to sort of eliminate some of those duplications, collaborate where possible. The report was also pretty clear. Despite the successes, we're at a crossroads. And if we don't continue to fund these programs, then it'll all be for naught. And that would be a real shame because these things are contributing to the economy. They are making Michigan a story nationally. They're starting to anyway.
I think people hear that term venture capital and kind of assume they understand it, but maybe really don't. Just what is venture capital and who are these venture capitalists?
They are high net worth individuals, we call them, aka rich people, that have money to invest in startups. Typically, the startups offer up a percentage of equity in exchange for the investment. Mm-hmm. And when you take VC money, you're also inviting that firm to kind of contribute major decisions to how you're going to go forward in your business. That's a reason that some companies choose not to take VC money, but many do because, frankly, it's often the only way to move forward.
I can hear between the lines of what you're saying that you feel that VC is extremely important to diversifying Michigan's economy.
Especially because we didn't really have much of a VC ecosystem in the early part of the 2000s.
And reputation matters when you're talking in VC world. And if you think about it, as you said, a lot of these investors are coming from outside Michigan, and here Michigan is competing with mature areas like Boston or Silicon Valley or Chicago. Mm-hmm. What is Michigan's reputation?
Investors are cautiously optimistic. They've certainly been putting more money into our startups here than ever before, but they are also still kind of at a wait and see point where they're watching the volatility in our legislature, how the budget to fund these programs goes up and down. And I think they are a little bit nervous. I think they want to bet on Michigan. I think they're very interested in a lot of the technologies we're developing here, particularly connected to autonomous vehicles, some of our life sciences efforts. But they don't want to gamble needlessly. I mean, it's risk capital, but
right back to this crossroads that we talked about.
Exactly.
So it kind of seems like the reputation might be Michigan's reputation a bit fragile.
Definitely fragile. Definitely fragile. Yes.
And in within our state, it does seem like we're not all on the same page in just how to develop our entrepreneurial ecosystem. Certainly, the state legislature slashed the budget of the MEDC, and it tried to end funding for these two funds of funds, the Venture Michigan Fund 1 and Venture Michigan Fund 2. That's the uncertainty that outsiders see, isn't it?
Yes. Admittedly, it can be a tough sell. You know, we still haven't funded roads. We've got Flint, we've got Detroit Public Schools, we've got some big expensive problems in the state. So it can be a little tougher proposition to say, hey, let's give our tax money to, you know, these random startups. And, you know, you have some of the more vocal critics suggesting that the state is picking winners and losers. I'm a small business owner. Why should my tax dollars go to this other tech startup? You know, I think it's a matter of we're not telling our story. We're not capitalizing on our successes the way we should be, both in state and at large in the country. And there, frankly, are a lot of intangibles that these programs support. I don't think you could come up with a dashboard of metrics for how different Detroit is now from when I moved there in 2009. But it's huge and it's important. And those are the kind of optics that can really change a state story and start drawing some of these young, innovative professionals to our state instead of having them all leave for the coasts.
If we don't tell our story better and we're at this crossroads and we don't go down the right path, what's at risk if we lose this momentum?
I mean, what's at risk is the ecosystem disappears. It would become a much more disparate ecosystem. Mm-hmm. The siloing, I have to imagine, would get worse. These programs, particularly, as I said, the VC fund of funds and the pre-seed funds that are funding very early stage homegrown startups. I don't know where we'd get the support, frankly, if these programs went away. We would hope the private sector would step up, but that's certainly no guarantee.
There was a recommendation that this report made, and the report done by a company out of Columbus, Ohio, right? So outsiders looking at Michigan. And there was a recommendation they made to the MEDC that the MEDC is not interested in following. What is that?
Well, the recommendation is that the state create a third fund to fund. Perhaps they change the structure of it a bit, but they keep the mission. When I was interviewing the MEDC right after the report came out, I said, are there any of these 11 recommendations that you disagree with or won't support? That was the only one that they mentioned when I said why. It was a pretty vague answer, which is what leads me to believe it's probably mostly political.
Interesting perspective looking at our 10 years of fighting to make Michigan a more diversified economy. Sarah Schmidt is a reporter with Exconomy Detroit Ann Arbor. Sarah, it was great to get your insights. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
Dark money paying to smear certain GOP candidates in last week's state primary?
There were examples of robocalls also being used. And they do this right before the primary election, so the one who is getting hit by the attack doesn't have a chance to respond. The news media doesn't have a chance to try to figure out what's going on with these groups.
And then in 10 minutes, get ready for the annual August Meteor Show, expected to be extra good this year.
They're predicting almost 200 an hour at the peak. But we have to bear in mind that predicting celestial phenomena is even harder than predicting the weather.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Looks like the dark money groups were pretty hard at work trying to influence your vote during last week's primary, particularly targeting Republicans running for the state house. Craig Mauger heads up the Michigan Campaign Finance Network. Craig, what did these secret donors do?
Well, what we found is that across five different GOP primary races, two groups tried to influence voters in the days before the primary election. A lot of times what we see with dark money funded groups is that they play in a particular race. A group will pop up and be pro one candidate and anti another candidate and try to help the candidate of the group's choosing to win. What is a little bit more unusual is that we had two groups in this situation essentially trying to play in a whole bunch of different races. So they were trying to make sure that certain candidates won, it appears, in five different races. So five races, that's quite a bit when you consider the House Republican caucus will probably be around 55 to 56 members, somewhere around there, depending how the election plays out. And if these groups are able to pick five members of that caucus and help them get elected, that's a large chunk of the caucus.
How did they do this? What kinds of tactics were used?
The tactics are to send out mailers against candidates who pose the biggest threat to the candidate of the group's choosing. So these groups most likely have polling that shows who is favored to win and who is second. And they send out negative mailers. Really vicious attacks is what we saw in this situation against the candidates who are doing well that these groups don't like and try to knock them down. They did radio advertisements. There were examples of robocalls also being used. And they do this right before the primary election. So the one who is getting hit by the attack doesn't have a chance to respond. The news media doesn't have a chance to try to figure out what's going on with these groups. And they do it as mystery groups, dark money funded groups that are extremely hard to trace, because then the candidate the groups is supporting doesn't get kind of the negative backlash of sending out really vicious attacks against his opponents.
I'm looking at the report that you have in Bridge Magazine, and here is a postcard that was aimed at attorney Catherine Henry in Belding. And it says, "Did Henry support Clinton and Obama?" And there's two really unflattering pictures, especially President Obama looking like he's winking at her. "Call Henry," and it puts out a phone number.
Yeah.
"Ask her if she is an Obama and Clinton supporter." So it's not saying who it's in favor of. It's just going after Catherine Henry.
Yeah, that's how these attacks are allowed to remain anonymous, because they don't tell you directly to vote for someone or to vote against someone like Henry. They just kind of say, here's the issue. She may like Democrats. Call her and ask her about it. Under Michigan's campaign finance laws, which are extremely weak, these types of attacks are allowed to go on anonymously. And that one mailer that you're referencing against Catherine Henry, who was running in West Michigan, was kind of less vicious compared to some of the others that we saw. One mailer alleged that a candidate was friends with a pervert and a felon. Another mailer alleged that a candidate only cared about herself, which is really a personal attack. And another mailer that I just found really interesting took on a candidate who only had raised $1,400 for his campaign. That's not very much. Some candidates raise $100,000. This guy, a dairy farmer from West Michigan, had raised $1,400 for his campaign. He was hit by one of these really negative mailers, and they said he was delinquent on his taxes for 15 years. He says that he was behind on his taxes for 1 year and just hasn't been able to catch up yet. He says it's not really the full story, but on this mailer that said he hadn't been paying his taxes, they put, "Call him at this number." They put the wrong number. Two of the numbers in his phone number were switched. and the number that they listed on the mailer had been disconnected. So if you called the mailer, it kind of put off the appearance that he hadn't also paid his phone bill and his phone had been disconnected. And the candidate who was the subject of this attack thinks that that was intentional to send a signal that he was also not paying his phone bill.
So, low blows. What are the politics behind this? Why were these candidates singled out? Not conservative enough? What do we think? Since as you say, we don't know who's behind this.
The prevailing theory is that these candidates tended to be the more conservative candidates in their races, and this was an effort, a pretty well orchestrated effort, to keep extremely conservative candidates out of the House GOP caucus. There are a lot of other theories of what might have been going on here. Some people have alleged that this had to do with the House GOP leadership race and who was going to be the next leader of the House GOP and potentially the next House Speaker, that this was an effort to get candidates who liked one of the Speaker or leader candidates elected. It's impossible to tell because we don't know who's funding these groups, and the people that whose names are attached with them simply say no comment whenever asked about them.
And the names of these groups: Michigan's Responsible Taxpayers and the 21st Century Leadership Fund.
Little vague, yeah. And these groups have also played in races previously. So that's one of the really scary things about these groups, is that they appear to be more tied to political consultants and lobbying firms, and they do appear to be tied to specific politicians. So basically, these firms or consulting groups can gear them up and take in money and use them as they see fit from election to election. And it makes it really, really difficult to trace who is potentially giving these groups money to levy the attacks. What could be happening here is that interest groups that want to see very specific policies put forward in next session's legislature could be trying to get people elected who will be in favor of those policies.
What is the takeaway, Craig, for voters as we swing into the general election? When we hear an ad or we have something hit the mailbox, what's the smell test here?
If you get an anonymous piece of mail that seems very vicious and seems very unusual, someone is behind that trying to influence your vote for a very specific reason. I mean, I think it's just another indication that voters need to be very aware of what's going on here, is that people are trying to use every means necessary to sway their vote, and there's probably a financial reason that that's happening. In addition, it's just another indication to voters in Michigan that our campaign finance rules are extremely weak. If a group wants to influence a vote anonymously, it's very easy to do that.
Craig Mauger heads up the Michigan Campaign Finance Network. You'll find his report on secret donors trying to shape the next State House GOP caucus on their website. You'll also find it at Bridge Magazine. Craig, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
When you or someone in your family feels sick or gets hurt, chances are the first call you make is to your primary care physician. Ever since 2010, Michigan has been a big part of a demonstration project to make primary care better, to keep people out of hospitals, keep them healthier. It's called the Michigan Primary Care Transformation Project. With us today as we continue our week-long look at the state of health care in Michigan, the project manager, Diane Marriott, and Natalie Adewunmi. She's a registered nurse and a care manager with the Arbor Park Office of Integrated Health Associates in Ann Arbor. Diane, you have described primary care physicians in today's offices, and these are your words, as hamsters running on a wheel. What do you mean by that?
Certainly, healthcare is changing, and as healthcare changes, there are more and more things that have practice has to grapple with. And often primary care is front and center at that. So sometimes it's described as doctors and care teams running faster and faster and faster on that hamster wheel. And this project is an opportunity to provide an additional resource and additional complements to the primary care office that will help not only the providers to feel more capable of really servicing patients, but also give some assistance to patients and connecting them. And Natalie is front and center at that. She's an example of a real live care manager. And care managers are the important resource that really is unique to this program.
Right. So let's talk about this role you have, Natalie, as a care manager. What do you do, first of all, in the office to help slow down the hamster wheel?
As a care manager, I definitely have more of a luxury of time with patients, and I have a panel of patients that are specifically mine to care for, and so I do get more time either on the phone with them or with the primary care physician in the office.
When we talk about these patients, are these could any patient get you, or do you have specific health concerns that you're there to help them with?
I work with patients that are either they have a complex health mm-hmm. history or very challenging illnesses that they're dealing with, but I also work with patients that were trying to reduce the risk or stop progression of, you know, something getting worse that I can work on goals with them also.
You actually track patients in basically in near real time. What does that mean?
Yeah, I think our real time efforts are twofold. You know, we get to be in the primary care physician's office, so we're getting lab values real time. We're getting discharges and admits real time. We're getting specialty notes so that we really can look at the whole picture. And the other part of real time is, I think, the proactive outreach. So there's a time when they're in the office, but that time in between, a lot of things come up. And as a care manager, being able to reach out to them has led to many very timely interventions for the patients.
And that could be through the phone, which
through the phone, yes.
Saves having somebody coming in and paying
That's
for
right.
a visit. So.
That's right. Yes, we do lots of telephone follow-up after they've been in the hospital. Right away, we're there reaching out to them, making sure they're stable at home and they have their questions answered and their medications straight, and then also in between appointments with physicians.
We're talking about the Michigan Primary Care Transformation Project and the way that this demonstration project is changing what primary care means in Michigan. We have the project manager, Diane Marriott, and we have a registered nurse and care manager, Natalie Adewunmi. I'm interested in another building block of this, and that is care available after hours. That's a big part of it, isn't it?
Such an important perspective. The concept of a patient-centered medical home or a primary care practice that goes above and beyond what patients have normally experienced in care includes access at extended hours. So not just that 9-to-5 or 8-to-5 time window. Perhaps that's time after hours in the evening. Perhaps that's time on a Saturday with the whole focus on being available to the patient when care is needed.
And we're not talking about the urgent care or the doc in a box. We're talking about, I love the term medical home. So it's the practice, if it would be going to Natalie's practice. Mm-hmm. So Arbor Park office, Integrated Health Associates, someone might be there after hours.
Yes, we have early morning hours. And as a care manager, I work one very late till 7 o'clock every week. And then we also have a call center that's attached to it's an IHA call center that allows patients to call any time of the night or weekends or holidays and is a resource to them.
So part of the Michigan Primary Care Transformation Project has been getting more care managers like Natalie into offices around Michigan?
Absolutely. There are 400 care managers through the training and really great job that our Care Management Resource Center has done. We have 345 practices. In those 345 practices, there are 400 care managers that are placed. We deal with 1,800 physicians and over 1.2 million patients throughout Michigan. So if you think about it, about a tenth of the state's population is serviced by the Michigan Primary Care Transformation Project. And we should also say that we couldn't do this without the support of our five payers, Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Michigan, Blue Care Network, Priority Health, Medicare, and Medicaid.
And this whole project was a government demonstration project. Show us how well you do, and Michigan was one of the 8 states picked?
That's exactly right. The original announcement came out in 2010, and it challenged states around the country who were interested in building these patient-centered home models to submit applications. Michigan submitted an application and was one of the 8 that were selected. We began our project on January 1st, 2012, and this is our 5th year.
And it should be noted, this was supposed to be a 3-year project, but let's talk about a good news story. Michigan has done so well.
Absolutely. From the results that we've seen to date in the Medicare evaluations, we're the best performing state among the 8. And after 3 years of operation, we sought advocacy for an additional 2-year extension, received it. And we're just so grateful to our stakeholders and to all the hard work of the participating practices. It really makes Michigan a great success story and one that serves the patients in Michigan.
Diane Marriott is with the Michigan Primary Care Transformation Project, and Natalie Adewunmi is a RN and care manager with Integrated Health Associates in Ann Arbor. I want to thank both of you for being with us. And again, the website to find out more is MIPCT.org. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, everybody, time to plan your Perseid party. The annual meteor show that we enjoy every August is expected to be extra special this year. With us now, Mary Stewart Adams at the Headlands International Dark Sky Park in Emmett County. Mary, we get this meteor show every August, but there certainly seems to be a buzz everywhere about this year's Perseids. What's the extra excitement about?
Yeah, I think there's a couple things going on behind that. One of them is internet acceleration, because the things that are happening in the sky are really popular topics on all social media. But also this year, the planet Jupiter has been, at least according to the astronomers, pushing on the debris stream that comes from the comet Swift-Tuttle. And that comet is the parent of this meteor shower. And when Jupiter pushes on it, it can increase the number of meteors that we see falling through our sky because it's closer. So they're predicting almost 200 an hour at the peak.
Oh, that'll be beautiful.
Yeah, yeah. But we have to bear in mind that predicting celestial phenomena is even harder than predicting the weather.
And speaking of, what's the viewing supposed to be throughout Michigan? Are we up for clear skies?
Well, up here in northwest lower Michigan, unfortunately, the forecast is not great. But I've been watching, and the peak is supposed to be tonight after midnight, so from Thursday into Friday, although this shower extends for quite a period of time. But if you're trying to look, after midnight tonight. And what's beautiful about that is that the moon, which is at waxing gibbous phase, it's getting bright, it's getting really big. Early in the evening, it will block out great views. But after midnight, it's starting to set. Of setting moon, falling stars, and there seems to be a break in the clouds.
So tell us, if we're not lucky enough to be able to make it up to where you are at the Headlands International Dark Sky Park, what's the best way and where do I look?
So what you want is an unobstructed view of the sky. So a large open field. Ideally, you want to be away from any kind of light pollution, so out of the city. And you just need a blanket or something that you can easily lay down on to look up. And you don't have to look in one particular region of the sky, because the meteors can fall all over the sky. Now, they're called the Perseids because the radiant, or the center point that the meteors seem to fall from, is in front of the constellation Perseus. So the rule of thumb is, the higher that constellation is in the sky, the stronger the meteor shower. So that's why we say, okay, after midnight it will be better. That's because Perseus is really high up. But you don't have to look at Perseus to see the shower.
It sounds like just a really fun thing to plan to do tonight after midnight. Drag a blanket out there and lay down and enjoy the best nature has to offer.
Right. And also you should avail yourself of the story of Perseus, because it's nice to have a story to share when you're under the stars.
Remind us.
Well, Perseus is the son of Danae and Zeus. Zeus actually comes to Danae in a form of a shower of golden stars. So this story about Perseus and the meteor shower predates any discovery of comets that causes meteor showers. So that's really lovely mystery. Perseus is a hero that slays the Medusa. He frees Andromeda. They do get to live happily ever after, which is uncharacteristic for the Greeks. So it's a great story.
Love it. Well, you can learn more about what's happening at the Headlands by going to midarkskypark.org. Mary Stewart Adams is the program director there at the Headlands on the shores of Lake Michigan in Emmett County. Always great to talk stars with you, Mary. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Today's Stateside was directed by Mike Blank. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Stateside was engineered today by Tony Brown. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.